Chapter 26. Marissa. Marissa pauses at a stop sign, taking an extra moment to ensure the cross street is clear before she presses down on the gas pedal. She's so worn out that even the extra cup of coffee she gulped this morning barely made a dent in her exhaustion, and though she's cutting it close in getting Bennett to school on time, she is careful to drive under the speed limit. The last thing they need is another accident. Back at home, Matthew is still asleep. True to form for her hard-charging husband, he overdid it yesterday afternoon by going to the office for a couple of hours and retrieving his car from the garage, then meeting her at Avery's for their fifth session. Marissa had suggested postponing it, but Matthew insisted he was fine. He might have been, but the visit to the police station, even though it was brief, seemed to put him over the edge. She couldn't recall the last time Matthew had taken a sick day, but he was doing so today. Matthew couldn't identify anyone from the lineup.
"I never saw his face," he explained to the police detective.
It appeared to be a random attack. Yet Marissa couldn't stop thinking about how Matthew's assailant ignored his expensive watch and wallet filled with cash and credit cards. The attack felt personal.
"Mom?"
Marissa looks in the rearview mirror and sees Bennett playing with his Rubik's Cube, twisting around the colorful pieces of plastic.
"Can we have pizza tonight?"
Bennett's timing is exquisite. Ordering out has never sounded so appealing.
"You know what? Maybe not pizza again, but we can definitely get takeout. Let's check with Dad, too. He's going to rest at home today."
Bennett nods.
"'Kay."
She tries to gauge his tone, but it's hard to decipher how he feels. Bennett knows Matthew got hurt. There was no hiding the bandage on Matthew's forehead. But they'd simply told their 8-year-old that his father had been in a minor car accident. Revealing Matthew had been assaulted would only have worried Bennett, even though Marissa is sure he would have loved to hear about Matthew's going to the police station and looking through the one-way mirror at suspects in a lineup.
"I'm going to be late,"
Bennett frets.
"No, you won't. We've got 90 seconds until the bell, and we're just about there."
Marissa pulls into the loop that will take them to the south entrance, where the third graders disembark and shake the hand of the lower school principal. Then she sees Natalie's familiar figure striding toward the main entrance. "Damn it," Marissa mutters, suddenly remembering the auction meeting she's supposed to attend this morning right after drop-off. Luckily, Bennett is too focused on his puzzle to mention the curse jar.
"Okay, sweetie, time to get out," she nudges. "Don't forget your lunchbox."
"Love you."
Bennett slides out of his seat.
"Love you too."
She feels the truth of the words down to her bones. She drives to the visitor parking lot and finds an empty spot, then glances in the rearview mirror and swipes on some lip gloss. She looks down at her leggings and faded sweatshirt and shrugs. They'll have to do, even though they don't fit the unspoken uniform of Rolling Hills mothers. Wearing exercise clothes to a parent-run meeting is acceptable, as long as it's an appropriate brand and doesn't have mysterious stains, such as the coffee dribbles Marissa sports on her right cuff. She rolls up her sleeves to hide the dark marks and fluffs her hair, wishing she had time to put on mascara and concealer. She feels so washed out. She hurries past the construction site of the new STEM building toward the lower school. Since she wasn't planning to even enter the building this morning, she has forgotten her parent ID at home. The guard gives her a temporary pass to affix to her sweatshirt, and Marissa strides down a hallway lined with photographs of Rolling Hills students dating back to its first class in 1924, toward the library's small conference room, where the auction committee is meeting. Just her luck. No other members are in sight. Just before she reaches the library, her phone vibrates. She checks the screen. It's Avery. Marissa declines the call. Through the closed conference room door, she can hear the muted sound of chattering, followed by Natalie's throaty laugh. Marissa's stomach tightens as she enters, and the heads of the 9 other committee members swivel toward her. But instead of stepping into the room, Marissa makes a swift decision. She isn't going to endure an hour of discussion about the incredible items the other committee members have procured for the live auction,
a private tour of the Washington Monument, dinner for six at the Inn at Little Washington, a chance to feed the Amur tigers at the National Zoo, while Natalie presides over it all. Morning, Marissa keeps her hand on the doorknob. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to let you know I won't be able to join you today after all. Natalie rises to her feet unhurriedly, smoothing her yellow pencil skirt. She has paired it with a patterned silk blouse and alligator print heels. Her amber-tinted sunglasses rest atop her head, pushing back her shiny dark hair. Marissa wonders if Natalie actually took the time to match the lenses with her outfit. Are you sure? Natalie asks. You're already here, Dawn adds in the same judgmental tone she used during the boys' baseball game 3 days ago. Marissa forces herself to smile. Unfortunately, there's been a bit of an emergency and I need to get, at the last moment, she decides to swap out the word home, to my store. Oh, can't that eager young assistant of yours cover the shop for a bit? Natalie pushes. Marissa feels an intense surge of dislike. She doesn't need to justify her decision to anyone, and she's not even going to bother responding to Natalie's last question. I'll see you all soon, Marissa says cheerfully, closing the door. As she drives back home, she tries to shake off her dark mood, the result of her brief encounter with Natalie. Marissa is glad she didn't give Natalie any indication the crisis involves Matthew being injured. Knowing Natalie, she'd probably swoop over with a hearty lasagna or casserole, one loaded with meat and cheeses and calories, the kind that most men can't resist, then make a point of checking up on Matthew. Marissa realizes her foot is pressing down harder on the accelerator, and she eases up. She swears she can feel her blood pressure rising. Ever since Natalie moved back to town, Marissa has tried to be a good sport. She looks the other way when Natalie places a hand on Matthew's sleeve or leans in a bit too close to talk to him. She pretends to not notice when Natalie keeps her eyes fixed on Matthew, all but ignoring Marissa. Those small aggressions have been piling up, though, and Marissa has finally reached her limit. Avery would probably tell Marissa to be direct, to cut away the veneer of false friendship and voice her frustration. The thought is oddly liberating. Marissa will relish telling Natalie off. But for now, her most important task is to get home and check on her husband. She slips into the house quietly. The kitchen is exactly as she left it, with Bennett's plate and empty orange juice glass in the sink. Marissa slides a coffee pod into the Nespresso maker and brews a cup, then carries it upstairs. Matthew is propped up in bed, checking his phone. Hey, she walks over to kiss him. You're supposed to be resting. She gives him the coffee. He takes a grateful sip.
I am resting. I'm still in bed. How much more relaxed could I be?
He sets his coffee on the nightstand and lifts up the covers, patting the empty spot next to him. Marissa smiles and slips in beside him. Careful to avoid his bruised ribs, she lays her head lightly on his bare chest. His arms tighten around her.
Marissa, I wanted to say this yesterday in Avery's office before we got interrupted.
His deep voice is serious. Beneath her left ear, she can feel the sure, steady beat of his heart.
I've done a lot of soul-searching these past few days. I want to be a better husband to you, and dad to Bennett. When I woke up in the ambulance, it was all I could think about. My regrets.
Marissa quashes the impulse to shush him, to tell him he's a wonderful husband and father. She remains silent because his words contain truth.
I'm going to be around more, I promise.
Matthew kisses the top of her head.
Starting now.
I would really love that. Is it possible, Marissa wonders, that all the horrible things that have happened will actually make their family stronger? She has been so achingly lonely in her marriage. If she is brutally honest with herself, as Avery has urged her to be, that feeling didn't just sprout up in the months leading up to her terrible indiscretion. It has existed throughout her relationship with Matthew, this sense that only a tenuous, gossamer tie links them, and that something as fleeting as a strong gust could blow them apart. She shivers involuntarily and snuggles closer to her husband, soaking in the warmth of his body. She can hear her phone buzzing on the nightstand, but she ignores it. If Bennett's school is trying to reach her, they have the home number.
So what's Bennett's schedule after school today?
Matthew asks.
Boy Scouts? Baseball? I was thinking I could pick him up.
Marissa doesn't correct him by saying it's Cub Scouts, not Boy Scouts, and that they always meet on Wednesday nights. Actually, he's free this afternoon.
Fantastic. I know what we can do. I'll take him to the batting cages. I can see how my little slugger is doing.
Marissa hesitates. There's something I need to tell you. Maybe this isn't the right time to mention it, but Bennett wants to quit baseball.
What?
Matthew sounds shocked.
He loves baseball. Didn't he tell us he got on base twice last week?
He was lying, Marissa says softly. He didn't want to disappoint us. Disappoint you, she silently clarifies. Matthew doesn't immediately reply. I'm sorry I brought it up, Marissa finally says. We don't have to talk about it now.
No, it's okay.
Matthew clears his throat.
You know, I've actually been thinking about my dad a lot lately.
In the pause that follows, Marissa holds perfectly still, barely breathing. She can't distract Matthew from what he may be about to say. Matthew never wants to discuss his father, whom Marissa calls by his first name, Chris, because she has never grown close enough to him to use the term dad. Even though he lives 20 minutes away, Matthew sees him only twice a year, on Christmas Eve and on Chris's birthday. Marissa and Bennett visit Chris more often, and Chris and Bennett also spend time together alone on occasion, going to a movie or bowling. Although Chris can be brusque to the point of rudeness around Matthew, he is unfailingly gentle with Bennett. Still, her husband would clearly be happier if he and his dad had no relationship at all. Marissa has long since given up trying to get Matthew to talk about it.
It is what it is. You know I don't like all that processing BS,
he would say whenever she tried in the past.
I did so many things I thought would impress him,
Matthew says now.
And it was never enough. I got good grades. I played sports. I married you,
he concludes with a little half laugh. Marissa has witnessed this subtle dynamic over the years. It's almost as if Matthew's father disdains Matthew for being Matthew, classically good-looking, savvy, a natural athlete, and born with the proverbial silver spoon. Marissa has always sensed that Chris somehow doesn't respect Matthew's innate gifts, as if he wanted his son to have to work harder, to struggle more, as he had. Marissa waits for Matthew to keep talking, but he seems lost in thought. Finally, she says carefully, I wonder if the way he grew up affected his relationships. Matthew's father was the oldest of four in a blue-collar family and worked part-time throughout high school to help his parents pay the bills. Chris didn't have time to play on sports teams or join the SGA or hang out at the diner with the other students. He didn't attend school dances because he didn't own a suit and figured no girl would want to go with a guy in a shabby blazer. When his father fell ill, Chris got his GED and began working full-time as a delivery boy for a DC lobbying firm, ferrying important documents all over town on his old 3-speed bike, but managed to earn his college degree by taking night classes. By the time Chris turned 32, he owned his own lobbying firm, and plenty of women were clamoring to be by his side, even though he still favored sturdy, well-worn clothes. He chose Matthew's mother, a Mount Vernon College graduate from a well-heeled family. He and the blue-blood debutante were obviously an abysmal match.
He hated the way my mother spent,
Matthew says now.
The clothes, the trips to the salons, our summer place. He would have bought a little fishing cottage, but she insisted on that big house.
Marissa's hand strokes slow circles on Matthew's arm, an echo of the movement she makes on Bennett's back when their little boy is upset.
Don't most parents want their kids to have a better life than they did?
Heat fills Matthew's tone.
I work my ass off. I deserve a nice house, a good car.
Of course you do. Even though Matthew got a huge running start in life, the best schools, his college tuition fully paid for, and a pedigree that guaranteed doors would open to him in business, she can understand his anger.
Marissa thinks back to the first and only time Chris visited them in their new home. Dinner had gone fairly well. Marissa made sure to have Chris's brand of scotch, Clooney, on hand, and she served steak and baked potatoes, which was his favorite meal. The conversation never flowed easily, though. Then Chris went out to his car. Although by then he could have bought a fleet of fancy foreign models, he drove an old Buick LeSabre. It refused to start. The engine repeatedly sputtered but wouldn't catch in the cold night air. Matthew went inside to call AAA, and when he came back out, Chris had the hood up and had gotten a toolbox out of his trunk. He was so focused on tinkering with the carburetor, he merely grunted,
"No,"
when Matthew asked if Chris wanted Marissa to make him some hot tea. After standing around for a few minutes, Matthew went back inside. By the time the tow truck had arrived, Chris had fixed the problem.
"You can't outsource everything in life,"
Chris had said.
"Though I guess you're used to having other people clean up after your messes."
He'd picked up his toolbox and closed the hood. The slam seemed to echo through the night. Matthew had never again invited his father over.
"Bennett's not going to feel the way I did,"
Matthew says now, his voice fierce.
"If he doesn't want to play baseball, he doesn't have to play baseball. We'll do whatever he wants this afternoon."
Marissa lifts herself up and kisses Matthew. "I love you," she whispers. He kisses her back, deeply, as he pulls her closer.
Chapter 27. Avery. I thrum my fingertips against my steering wheel, keeping watch out my window while I speculate about the man who hurt Matthew. When the bishops rushed out in the middle of our session to go to the police station last night, Matthew promised to fill me in on what happened. I got a text from him a few hours later, letting me know he couldn't identify anyone in the lineup and that the police didn't seem to have a real suspect. As of now, it appears to be a random attack. Still, I've decided not to wait until Monday to learn about the man Marissa slept with. I reach for my cell phone and dial Marissa's number. It rings a few times, as it did when I called earlier this morning, then goes to voicemail again. Last time I didn't leave a message. Now I do, asking her to phone me back as soon as possible with the name of the person we discussed at the Chevy Chase Circle. Enough is enough. I need to check him out. The front door of the house I'm watching opens, but the person who steps out isn't the one I'm waiting for. It's a tall, gangly-looking guy with longish hair. He shifts his backpack higher up onto his shoulders and walks past me, never even looking in my direction. I shift in my seat and exhale, then glance at the dashboard clock. It's 9:15. I should have pushed Marissa to tell me more that day about her infidelity when we stood in the middle of the traffic circle, but she seemed so broken and afraid that I merely told her not to worry and that I'd handle everything. I regret this tactic now. I'm beginning to wonder if Marissa emotionally seduced me the way she probably seduced the man she slept with. And the way she must have seduced Matthew, too, all those years ago. Not overtly through her sexuality, as Natalie would, but with a subtle vulnerability. Marissa is gorgeous and fragile with her soft voice, delicate frame, and long-lashed cornflower blue eyes. Her magnetism is quiet, but undeniable. Even Polly fell under her spell. What if there never was another guy? Perhaps she's been stalling because there is no name to offer up. Marissa has already created one major fabrication, saying she slept with a near stranger from her gym, and it's entirely possible her lies didn't end there. But what would be her motivation? From early on, I've sensed the bishops are more complex than my typical clients, and I'm still not convinced Marissa is the only one hiding something. Matthew's swift acceptance of me and my methods seems almost too compliant. Plus, there was that phone call outside Mon Ami Gabi and the revelation that he told Natalie, not his wife, about the lost business account. Like his wife, Matthew seems almost too perfect. If either or both of them is playing a game, I'm several moves behind and I desperately need to catch up. My day is jam-packed, with appointments stacked up, a meeting with my accountant to answer his many questions about my taxes, a visit from the mobile vet to give Romeo his Bordetella vaccine, and sessions with three clients, including a brand new one. But one way or another, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. There is just one thing I need to attend to first. As if on cue, the front door of the group house opens and Polly steps out, blinking in the bright morning sunlight. As she walks toward her VW Rabbit parked at the end of her walkway, she scans her phone. She is so absorbed that she doesn't even notice me until I am nearly by her side. "Hey, Polly," I say casually. "Got a minute?" She starts, then looks from side to side, as if seeking an escape route. "I have to get to work." "You have some time. I'll be quick." Discomfort spreads across her face. She's clearly trying to come up with a reason to say no, but she must not be able to think of one. It's chilly and the wind feels fierce. Polly is wearing the same lightweight turquoise jacket she had on the other night. As she shoves her hands into her pockets, I notice her nose is already beginning to redden. "You're cold. Why don't we sit in my car and talk? Or yours, if you'd rather." I'm hoping she'll choose her car because you can learn a lot about someone by checking out their personal spaces when they don't have advance warning. She hesitates, then as another gust of wind hits us, she uses her key fob to unlock the doors to her vehicle. The passenger seat is clear, unlike in my car, and everything is well organized, just like her purse. A blue hair scrunchie is wrapped around the gear shift, a stainless steel water bottle is tucked in the cup holder, and a pack of disinfecting wipes is in the console. Polly starts the engine and a Britney Spears song blares. She quickly reaches for a knob and turns off the radio. I wait for her to begin the conversation. A moment later, she does. "What did you want to talk to me about?" "I know strange things have been happening around Coco, like the creepy note you found. I need you to tell me what else is going on." I speak with authority, hoping Polly will succumb to it, as she did when I searched Coco. But maybe she learned from that experience. "I'm sorry, but I'm not really sure I can tell you anything. I mean, not without permission." "Marissa's permission? Polly, she is in danger. Matthew told me you called him to say you were worried about her. Do you really think I'd be here if the bishops didn't want my help?"
"He told you that?"
Polly looks surprised.
"Yes, he also told me you drove all the way down to Giovanni's restaurant to try to see him."
"Okay,"
Polly shifts in her seat.
"So I didn't think it was a big deal at first, but twice in the past week, a guy has called and asked for Marissa. When I asked who it was, Marissa taught me to do that before handing the phone to her. He hung up."
"Any idea who it could have been?"
"No, I didn't recognize his voice. And there have been a few hang-ups, too, like someone keeps calling because they hope she'll answer instead of me."
I play the devil's advocate. "Could be a telemarketer."
"I don't think so."
Polly is practically bristling. She has a lot invested in her role in Marissa's life, and Polly doesn't like me downplaying the drama she feels she's a central part of.
"Is that all?"
I keep my tone a little bored. Polly takes the bait.
"There's actually video footage from the store that night when someone put that note under the door."
"There is?"
I can't believe I didn't think to ask the bishops about this, or that they hadn't mentioned it.
"Yes, and here's the thing. I asked Marissa about it, and she told me she checked the footage, but the camera angle was off and it was too blurry to see anything."
I reflexively glance at the purse on Polly's lap, wondering if the note is still tucked inside.
"But,"
Polly's voice drops and she leans closer to me. I suddenly have an image of her as a young girl in a school classroom, whispering into the ears of other children, spreading rumors and sowing discord before smiling innocently up at the teacher and offering to wipe down the cafeteria tables after lunch.
"I checked the video too. I called the company and asked them to email us a copy of the recording from that night. they sent it over to the store's account, which of course I check every day. Anyway, I thought maybe I'd see something Marissa missed, and I did. I saw the guy who left the note.
Did you recognize him? I ask urgently. Polly nods proudly.
At first I couldn't place him, but then I realized who he was.
Get to the point, Polly, I want to scream.
He's this homeless man, Ray, who usually sits on a bench down the street from our shop. He always has these funny signs. Do you think he's the one who is obsessed with Marissa? I know she buys sandwiches for him sometimes.
I blink hard, trying to sort and categorize what I've just learned. If I trust the information Polly has given me, and it should be easy enough to verify, I've just learned something crucial. Matthew and I aren't the only people Marissa has lied to. She blatantly deceived Polly about the contents of the video camera. Marissa must have known for days who put the note under the door. Anger sweeps through me. She conned me. Again. The theory I've been playing around with, that Marissa never actually had an affair, could be bolstered by this new information. Perhaps Marissa asked the homeless man to leave the note. Maybe she is arranging for the calls Polly has been answering at Coco. Marissa could even have sent herself flowers, timing their arrival so that Matthew and I would be there to witness it. If Marissa created this elaborate scenario to try to cast herself as a victim and get attention from her husband, or for some other more sinister reason, she has succeeded, I think, remembering how Matthew held his arm around her protectively during our last session. 1% of the population is composed of psychopaths, and most of them aren't the homicidal criminals we envision. We've all encountered them. People who seem charming and charismatic, but who lie without remorse and manipulate and deceive. And female psychopaths can be particularly adept at manipulation. I think back to the moment the bishops first entered my home, looking like the couple who had everything. I've spent the past few weeks trying to get to know them intimately, yet they still feel like strangers. Then I look over at Polly. Have you told Marissa you saw the footage? Polly shakes her head. But you drove all the way downtown to tell Matthew?
He's worried about her. Like, really worried. I just felt like I should tell him.
Polly is studying my face, nakedly eager for our conversation to continue now. Is that all?
Isn't that enough? She cries.
Actually, there is one more thing. How did you enjoy working at Anthropology? Polly has a terrible poker face. Her flesh extends to include her ears. Or maybe she's a brilliant actress.
Look, I didn't really have a job there, okay? Please don't tell Marissa. The truth is, I had stopped working as a nanny and I was temping when I walked into Coco and I never wanted to leave. It's sophisticated and elegant and everything.
Polly looks down at her lap and her final words come out as a whisper.
Everything I'm not.
I breathe in deeply, wondering if she's talking about Coco or the woman who owns the boutique. I'll let you get to work now. I open the car door, but before I step out, I decide to toss her a bone. Polly could be useful in the future. It was very smart of you to check the camera. She smiles, and I straighten up, shutting the door and watching her drive away. I learned a lot about Marissa during the past couple of minutes. She has plenty to answer for, and I deliberately didn't tell Polly I am also heading to Coco, because I don't want Marissa to have any warning of my impending arrival. But I learned something about Polly, too. Every time I inhaled, I smelled a delicate floral perfume. Subtle, but distinctive enough that I recognized it. It's the scent Marissa wears.
Chapter 28. Marissa.
Marissa doesn't arrive at Coco until almost 11, and even Polly's usual barrage of questions or the news that Avery stopped by unexpectedly right after the store opened, hoping to catch Marissa, can't erase Marissa's smile. Her chin is slightly red from rubbing against Matthew's unshaven stubble, and throughout the day she finds her hand rising to touch the tender skin, as if to seal in the memory. Lovemaking with Matthew felt different this morning. Powerful, raw, fierce. Marissa can't put her finger on the exact word to describe it, but those come close. Matthew's eyes had been closed. He'd seemed to lose himself completely in the physical act, not even feeling the pain of his injuries. At the very end, he'd opened his eyes and stared into hers.
"You're mine,"
he'd whispered. Polly touches Marissa's shoulder. "Marissa?" Marissa pulls herself away from the reverie. "Yes, what is it?"
"I was just saying a few gift certificates came in for your school benefit."
"Great, put them in the back room along with the rest of the auction items. I need to get them to..." Her voice trails off before she completes the final word in her sentence. "Natalie." Marissa frowns, watching as Polly picks up the gift certificates. Polly is asking if Marissa wants her to order more tissue paper inserts for the shopping bags, since they're down to a few hundred sheets. Marissa nods, but it's a different question, one that was asked by Natalie earlier this morning that Marissa is focused on.
"Oh, can't that eager young assistant of yours mind the shop?"
As far as Marissa knows, Natalie has been to Coco exactly once, and it was more than a year ago. She was in the neighborhood, Natalie had explained, as she'd greeted Marissa with a kiss on the cheek that left a smudge of coral lipstick. Natalie wandered through the store, taking it all in with an appraising eye, and left without purchasing a thing. At the time, Marissa's assistant was a woman in her mid-50s, a mother of twins who'd decided to return to the workforce after her children left for college. Natalie would never refer to her as young. She must have been talking about Marissa's current assistant. But how does Natalie know such specific details about Polly? Marissa's breath catches as she recalls Polly's roommate asking if she, Marissa, was Polly's boss at the real estate company. Natalie is a real estate agent. Could Polly have temped at the same company where Natalie works? Do they actually know each other? The skin on Marissa's arms prickles as she watches Polly open the store's laptop, using the password Marissa provided her, and begin updating the spreadsheet containing customers' contact information. Polly seems to feel Marissa's gaze and looks up.
"Oh, I forgot to tell you, Janice Henderson called yesterday and asked me to let her know when we get in more size 8 swimsuits. I was just making a note of it."
"Great." Marissa casually walks into the back room, but keeps Polly in her peripheral vision. Polly has access to most of Coco's business information. She knows every inch of the shop. She has even slept here. She has slept in Marissa's home, too. Marissa's heart is pounding. She forces herself to draw in a few even, slow breaths as she thinks back to the circumstances of Polly's hiring. Polly had wandered into the shop a month or so ago, all fresh-faced and sweet-seeming. It was a slow Monday morning, and Polly had knowledgeably discussed a few items Marissa sold, favorably comparing Coco's hand-blown glass vases to the brand carried by Anthropology. As Marissa was bringing up the picture frame Polly selected, Polly had said almost wistfully, "It would be a dream to work in a place like this. You don't happen to need any help, do you?" A few days later, Polly showed up for her first day at Coco. Marissa had verified the first job on Polly's resume, a nanny position, but the manager at Anthropology didn't return Marissa's call, so she let it go.
"Marissa?"
Marissa flinches at the sound of Polly's voice. Polly pokes her head into the back room, and Marissa studies her carefully. Polly is wearing her hair pulled back into a twist today, a style Marissa occasionally favors, and has on an ivory sweater sold by Coco, which Marissa gifted to Polly because a customer got a lipstick stain on the inside collar while trying it on.
"Oh, there you are," Polly continues. "I was just wondering if there's anything special you need me to do now, or..."
You can rearrange the shelves by the standing mirror. Marissa conjures this up to keep Polly tucked away in a far corner of the shop. The sundry t-shirts are selling well, so make sure they can be easily seen. Polly nods, and as she heads off to tackle the task, Marissa's composure returns. It strains credulity to think that Natalie would send Polly to work at the shop and keep tabs on Marissa. What would be the purpose? If Natalie has her sights set on Matthew, there are far less complex ways to try to entice him. Still, something about Polly is fishy. Marissa has arranged to interview on Monday morning the best candidate from the resumes she has received. She'll tell Polly to run a few made-up errands to get her out of the way. If the applicant is as promising as she seems, Marissa will give Polly her official notice on Monday afternoon. Maybe Marissa will do it right after her meeting at the coffee shop, so that Monday will feel like a day of clearing away the tainted, stressful pieces of her life and beginning anew. Marissa checks her watch at a little after 3:30 p.m. Matthew would have picked up Bennett by now, and they're probably on their way to whatever it is they decided to do. Maybe they'll get ice cream or go to the zoo again. Even though Marissa came in late, she's tempted to leave early. She can order something yummy from DoorDash for dinner and set out Monopoly or Scattergories so everything is waiting for her two guys when they walk through the door. It would mean giving Polly free rein of Coco, but by now Polly has surely seen every square inch of the shop. Still, Marissa plans to take the store's laptop with her. She finishes tracking down a special order and checking out a new handbag company based out of Austin, then begins packing up just as her cell phone rings. She expects it to be Avery since they've been playing phone tag today, but Matthew's photo flashes on the screen.
"Hey, babe,"
he says when she answers. Marissa can tell she's on speakerphone. She hears Bennett giggling in the background.
"We've got a little surprise for you."
"Oh, really?" Marissa's voice sounds tight and strained, so she makes an effort to lighten it. "What are you two cooking up?"
"You're going to the spa,"
Bennett shouts. "The spa?" Marissa echoes.
"We booked you a massage at the Red Door,"
Matthew confirms.
"Can you get there in 30 minutes?
Marissa can't disappoint them, not when they're so clearly excited. "Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing.
Dad just bought me that blaster faster rocket, the one that goes up 75 feet.
Bennett's voice is pure joy.
"We're going to Candy Cane City to launch it.
"Take a video?" Marissa asks. "I'd love to see."
"Yep, and let's just order in dinner when you come home,"
Matthew tells her.
"Make it a lazy night."
"Love you both," Marissa cries, but she can't tell if they hear her before Matthew disconnects the call. Marissa tucks her cell phone into her bag and reaches for her light spring coat. She knows it's ridiculous to complain about getting a massage, but she feels a deep tug toward her family right now. She only wants to be with Matthew and Bennett. It's a longing that is imbued with urgency. So much has happened lately. It's natural that she is nervous and jittery, she tells herself. But it's more than that. She's scared. Marissa closes her eyes and conjures an image of Bennett's smiling face. His wide blue eyes, the freckles that dance across his nose, his gap-toothed smile. Her son isn't in danger. He's going to a public park on a sunny afternoon where there will doubtless be other kids and parents and nannies. Besides, Matthew would never let anything happen to Bennett, Marissa tells herself. With that thought, she finally exhales.
Chapter 29. Avery. By the time the sun begins to set, I still haven't reached Marissa. She didn't show up at Coco this morning. I didn't even get a glimpse of Ray, which made going there a complete waste of time.
"Yeah, she texted me to say she was coming in late. You should have told me you were planning to come by. I could have saved you the trip,"
Polly had said with a bit of an edge, as if she was happy I'd been inconvenienced. When Marissa did call me back, I had my hands full, literally, consoling Romeo while the vet administered his shot, and I couldn't pick up, so she left a message simply saying she was sorry we'd missed each other. But she didn't provide the name I'd requested. Then I received an urgent text from a client who'd had an altercation with his new boss, and I spent the next hour talking him down. When I finally got the chance to phone Marissa back, her voicemail came on, and a moment later she texted, "With a customer, sorry." I can understand why Marissa would rather not text or email the name of the guy to me. A paper trail could come back to haunt her if Matthew has access to her accounts. But there's no reason why she couldn't have left the information on my voicemail, as I specifically instructed. But she hasn't. Now it's early evening, and I've got a few minutes before my last appointment of the day. A new client who told me she is grappling with an enormous betrayal, which is likely another case of infidelity. I reach for my phone again. My call goes straight to voicemail, as if Marissa has turned off her cell. It feels a little too convenient that her mysterious lover has been out of town all week, and suddenly Marissa seems to be avoiding me. I wonder again if she is playing me. I want to throw the coffee cup I'm holding against the floor and watch it shatter. As soon as my final session is over, I'm heading over to the Bishop's. I'm going to corner Marissa tonight. Romeo pads into my office and looks at me, his expression concerned, as if he has intuited my irritation. He nudges his cold nose beneath my palm, and I stroke his head, which is finally free of the cone, since the vet told me I could remove it. I stand up, and Romeo follows me as I enter my living room. I open the back door to let him out into the fenced yard, tossing his favorite squeaky toy hot dog onto the lawn. He bounds off to get it, but refuses to drop it at my feet, so we have a little rough-and-tumble game of tug-of-war that I probably need more than he does. When my new client, Rose DeMarco, rings my doorbell at 6 o'clock p.m. sharp for her first session, Romeo is upstairs in his crate, and I'm ready for her. I peer out the peephole, noticing she looks better than the photo on her driver's license. Then again, most of us do. I never used to ask clients to send me identification in advance of our first session, but thanks to Acelia, I can no longer afford to let anyone in my house that I haven't checked out. I open the door and welcome Rose inside, showing her to my office and indicating the coat rack where she hangs her navy blue belted jacket. I take my usual chair, and Rose settles herself on the middle cushion of the couch across from me. "So, what brings you here today?" I begin. I know already from verifying the information on the driver's license she scanned and sent to me that Rose is 27 and lives in Adams Morgan. Through my own digging, I discovered she works as a history teacher at a private girls' school in Bethesda, which makes it surprising that she can cover my fee, but perhaps she comes from family money. Rose crosses her legs at the ankle. She's wearing a below-the-knee skirt and flats, and her permed, shoulder-length hair and shapeless patterned sweater aren't doing her any favors. "I've experienced a terrible betrayal, but I have a feeling you can help me find the solution." "That's what I do best." What usually comes at this point is a long pause. When clients first meet me, they need to take a minute to compose their swirling thoughts and lay out their confession in a succinct way, trying to summarize the problem that has likely consumed many of their waking hours for weeks, months, or even years can be a big challenge. But Rose doesn't hesitate. "Someone discovered my very private information and shared it with the worst possible person." I wait for Rose to elaborate, but she doesn't. "Was it a boyfriend who betrayed you?" I imagine compromising photos posted on the internet.
"No."
"A friend? A family member?" Rose shakes her head twice. "We could save a lot of time if you just tell me who did it."
"A colleague," Rose says evenly.
It's not what she says that makes me put my notebook down in my lap, freeing my hands. It's the way she says it. The room is perfectly still. Romeo is upstairs in his crate. There's no audible ticking of a clock or faint waft of music or distant honking from rush hour traffic. It's as if Rose and I are suspended together in a glass globe. I choose my next words carefully. "What makes you think I can help you?"
"I have a strong hunch." A bead of sweat rolls down the side of Rose's face, but she doesn't make a move to wipe it away.
In fact, I think you're the only one who can help me.
I casually place my hands on my chair's armrests, fighting my body's instinct to clench. I need to appear relaxed and unconcerned.
The only thing I was wondering about is your fee.
I mentally begin compiling facts. Her skin is pale, and she has no birthmarks or scars or freckles on her face, unless she has covered them up. Her eyes are hazel, but those could be colored contacts. It's impossible to tell her body shape beneath her clothes. I play along for the moment. My fee is non-negotiable. If we decide to work together, I'll need to be paid up front.
That won't be a problem. I already know I want to work with you.
And I've already decided we aren't going to work together, I think, mentally willing myself to memorize the precise sound of her voice.
But if you do help me the way I think you will, I'm going to be so grateful I'll want to pay you a lot more.
I shift again in my chair, casually moving my left hand an inch lower on the armrest. I don't allow secrets in this room, Rose. Tell me why you're here or this session is over. My index finger finds the smooth button on the underside of my chair's armrest, but I don't push it. Not yet. Rose's clothing doesn't contain any visible pockets, and her hands are clasped on her lap. Her purse is down by her feet. Her posture is unthreatening. Still, I don't take my eyes off her for an instant. Despite the thermostat in my home being set at 70 degrees, another bead of perspiration rolls down her cheek, leaving a faint, glistening trail. I wonder what her real hair color is beneath the wig that is making her head sweat. If I passed her on the street, I wouldn't give her a second glance. She blends in. Medium height, medium weight. There's nothing striking about her, which is probably exactly why she was chosen to come see me.
I didn't come here under false pretenses. I'm being straight with you.
Rose's eyes stay fixed on mine.
Like I told you, I experienced a huge betrayal by a colleague. This person has caused a lot of trouble for me and my company. You know who it is. So how about it, Avery? Can we work together?
Her words are so deliberate. To an outsider, they'd probably appear strange but innocuous. I force myself to smile.
I don't think my methods are a good fit for you, Rose.
Why don't you see yourself out? This is it, the moment when everything could shift. But Rose merely gets to her feet, reaching for her coat and slinging her purse over her shoulder.
If you change your mind, you've got my number and email address,
which are connected to a burner phone and untraceable electronic address, I'm certain. I don't reply. She cocks her head and gazes at me.
You've got such a pretty face.
She looks around my office.
And such a nice house. Sometimes we don't realize how grateful we should be until we lose everything.
She smiles and slips on her coat. Despite her implicit threat, I'm certain Rose came here not to harm me, but to try to strike a deal. Money in exchange for the name of who gave me the information. Still, it's difficult to remain seated while she disappears into the hallway. A moment later, I hear the sound of my front door shutting and her footsteps going down the outside stairs. Only then do I take my finger off the panic button that alerts police and my alarm company I'm in danger. I walk to the window and watch Rose disappear down the sidewalk, blending into the dark shadows. I wonder what she really looks like beneath her plain disguise. She must resemble the real Rose DeMarco, who probably has no idea that her identity was borrowed for tonight. Acelia must have searched for an innocuous-seeming local woman who wouldn't raise any suspicion in me, creating a copy of her driver's license and sending a fake client who looked enough like Rose that I'd open my door.
But as with everything else Acelia has done, no real harm resulted, and the details are murky enough that I can't report this incident to the police without appearing paranoid. What I can do is to implement a new policy. I'll only meet new clients in public places. I walk into my hallway and activate my alarm system, staring at the logo on the code box. It's the same logo Derek had on his work shirts. Derek protected me well, I think. It was he who suggested installing the panic button on my work chair. I'm gripped with the urge to call him, but even as I'm pulling out my phone, I realize how unfair that would be. Derek would provide me with comfort. I'd repay him with pain. I slide my phone back into my pocket and go upstairs to let Romeo out of his crate.
Chapter 30. Marissa. Marissa lies on the massage table, willing herself to relax, while a woman with salt and pepper hair pulled back in a bun works on the knots in Marissa's lower back. Beneath the notes of the classical music through the salon's speakers, she hears the incessant thudding of her heart. The padded cushion against her face makes it hard to breathe. "How is the pressure?" the masseuse asks. "Fine," Marissa manages to whisper. But surely her rigid body tells a different story. What is she doing here? She should have trusted her instincts and skipped the treatment and gone home. Or better yet, driven straight to Candy Cane City to meet Matthew and Bennett. She berates herself for letting down her guard. Someone is trying to hurt them. Matthew has already been hurt. They aren't safe. "I'm sorry," Marissa abruptly twists onto her side, pulling the sheet around her as she sits up. "I suddenly don't feel well. I need to go." The masseuse begins to apologize. "It isn't anything you did," Marissa assures her hastily. Finally, the woman exits, and Marissa puts on the terry cloth robe and slippers the spa provides its clients. When Marissa first entered the room, the last of the day's sunshine was creeping through the slanted blinds, a fractured bit of brightness. Now there's only darkness. She feels lightheaded and disoriented. Marissa pushes out the door into the hallway. She hurries into the locker room to retrieve her purse, her cell phone, and other belongings. A woman is putting her things in the locker immediately above Marissa's, blocking the way, so Marissa waits, her stomach coiling tighter with each passing second. Finally, the woman steps aside and Marissa moves forward, tapping in her usual 4-digit code. The locker door swings open and Marissa immediately pulls her phone out of her purse. There's nothing except another missed call from Avery. She knows Avery wants the name of the man she slept with, but there is no way Marissa is leaving that information on voicemail. A sign on the wall announces the use of cell phones in the locker room is prohibited, and an attendant is nearby, setting out fresh towels, but Marissa can't stop herself. She curves her body to block the view of the attendant and calls Matthew's cell phone. It rings several times, then goes to voicemail. She instantly tries again, but Matthew doesn't pick up. He's probably playing a video game or watching TV with Bennett, she tells herself. The phone is vibrating right next to him on the end table by the couch. He just can't hear it. She knows she isn't behaving rationally, but her premonition is so strong she can't help herself. "Call me ASAP," she texts. She waits, her body frozen, but there's no response from her husband. Just as on the night he was attacked. Marissa yanks on her clothes, then pulls on her boots and coat, leaving her hair twisted up in the terry cloth scrunchie the masseuse offered her. She doesn't even glance in the mirror. Her movements are quick and jerky, fueled by the certainty she needs to get home. She flies out the door of the spa and takes the stairs down 2 flights rather than waiting for the elevator. She hurries to the parking lot and slips behind the wheel of her car, barely waiting for the attendant to accept her ticket and raise the electronic gate before she races through it. At the first stoplight, she calls their home phone, even though all the ringers are turned off downstairs so they aren't bothered by telemarketers. No one answers. When the light turns, she swerves into the lane to her left, then back to her original one, trying to jockey ahead in the traffic-filled streets a few inches at a time, just like the drivers she normally complains about. Matthew and Bennett are safe at home, she tells herself, repeating it like a mantra. She'll walk through the door and Matthew will look up at her and smile while Bennett chatters excitedly about his new rocket. They'll devour the tacos and guacamole and chips Matthew picked up for dinner. Then they'll all snuggle on the couch and watch a movie. It will be a perfect night.
That's an Instagram photo, she hears Avery's voice chide.
But it won't be, she assures herself, because she and Matthew are changing, because their marriage finally feels as if it is becoming the union she used to only pretend it was. Matthew and Bennett are safe at home, she repeats aloud. She's so close to them. In another few blocks, she'll turn off the main artery into their neighborhood. She continues winding her way north, passing the treacherous circle that divides D.C. and Maryland, then turning down a quieter road. Everything is as it should be on her street, she realizes. There are no sirens, no flashing blue and red lights from police cars or ambulances, no cluster of gaping neighbors in front of their home. Her body finally unclenches a bit when she sees Matthew's car in the garage. He must have left the door open for her, but she leaves her car parked on the driveway apron, not taking the time to fit it into the enclosed space. Marissa grabs her purse from the passenger seat and slams the car door, then begins to hurry toward the house. She can't fully relax, not until she lays eyes on her family. A loud honk sounds behind her, and she whirls around. Bright headlights shine in her eyes, and she instinctively raises her hand to shield them. Then she hears her name being called. Marissa!
Chapter 31. Avery. When new clients come to me with a confession, it's often camouflage for their actual issue, which exists below the surface of their conscious lives. It lurks in a place that feels too hazy and perilous for them to enter alone, if their mind allows them to be aware of it at all. I reach for my phone and replay the message Marissa left me this afternoon. Hi, Avery. I'm sorry we keep playing phone tag. I know you are eager to catch up, and I'll be... Sorry about that. Anyway, I'm sure we'll talk soon. Her message wasn't entirely directed at me. She briefly spoke to someone else midway through it, probably pulling her phone away reflexively for a moment. I close my eyes. Marissa was walking down a busy street, probably Connecticut Avenue, near Coco, judging by the background noises. Her aside was a bit muffled, but I play the message again, focusing intently on the words she spoke between I'll be and sorry about that, to confirm I've heard them correctly.
Oh, hi, Ray.
The name isn't terribly common, but I heard it just this morning when I went to visit Polly. He's the homeless man Polly recognized on the video, the one who pushed the note under Coco's door late at night. He wasn't near the store when I stopped by earlier, but he must have returned by the time Marissa left me a message. Something has always bothered me about that letter, as it has about the delivery of those roses. Both acts were supposedly anonymous, yet both seemed designed to engender witnesses. If the man who seems obsessed with Marissa wanted to leave her a note, why didn't he simply put it in an envelope with her name on it, ensuring her privacy? Or for that matter, send her a text or an email, rather than print out a single line on a sheet of white paper and arrange for it to be delivered to Coco. I stand up from my desk and walk across the room, Romeo trailing at my heels. I'd let him out of his crate as soon as the fake Rose DeMarco left, and although I refuse to be shaken by her visit, I can't pretend that my dog's presence isn't comforting. We head to the kitchen, where I give Romeo a rawhide bone and check to make sure he has fresh water. Marissa should be home for the night by now. And one thing I've learned in my work, which was proven again only this morning with Polly, is that people tend to be more forthcoming when you catch them off guard. I leave on plenty of lights for Romeo and double-check that the house alarm is set while he's busy gnawing on his treat. Back soon, I call to him as I head out my door, toward the bishop's house and our sixth session. Traffic is in full force, but I'm not in any rush. I stay in the middle lane of Connecticut Avenue, thinking about what I know of the bishops. If I were my own patient, I might accuse myself of avoiding my lurking issue, the escalating threat posed to me by Acelia.
Avoidance, suppression, denial, a lot of clinical terms could be applied to my actions, since I'm heading to the bishop's right now instead of trying to process the intrusion I just experienced. I'm not going to allow Acelia to take up any more of my mental real estate, though. That monstrous company wants me to be cowering at home, fearing what it might do to me next. But even though I'm confident they've researched me thoroughly, they must not know this about me. I've never liked bullies. I pass through the circle that straddles the DC to Maryland line, braking hard to avoid a pickup truck that doesn't seem to understand the concept of yielding. I honk, and when the driver gives me the finger, I fire one right back at him. I reach Marissa and Matthew's street a few minutes later. It's like turning into a different world. Only blocks away is a city filled with noise and bustle. I drove over 3 potholes on my way to get here and passed a bus shelter that held a half dozen weary-looking people. Here, graceful 3-story homes are set back from the road, buffered by well-tended yards and expensive cars. It's quieter, and the roads are perfectly paved. As I pull up in front of Marissa's house, I spot her getting out of her Audi in the driveway. I honk, and my headlights pass over her. She turns around and lifts her hands to shield her eyes. Marissa, I call.
Oh, Avery.
She puts her hand to her heart.
You startled me.
Good timing. I pull in behind her car. I'm glad I caught you alone. Mind if I park here? I'll be quick. She glances at her house, then back at me.
What is it?
Nervous energy is radiating from her. I can tell she's distracted. I was hoping we could talk. Remembering my conversation with Polly, I suggest, how about we sit in your car for a few minutes? Marissa shakes her head almost imperceptibly.
I'm sorry, no, I need to go inside first.
It's the first time I've ever spoken with her that her words have emerged choppy and unpolished. Marissa's hair is piled up in a scrunchie, and a smear of mascara is under her left eye. One of her pant legs is caught inside her high-heeled leather boot, and the other one hangs free. My poised, glamorous, perfect client seems to be falling apart. This will be our 6th session, confrontation. For Cameron, it meant finally standing up to his wife, Skylar. For Kimberly, whose parents minimized her rape, it meant writing them a letter detailing how they'd failed her. It's not lost on me that I literally had to confront Marissa to arrange this meeting. I'm the architect of my method, but the contents of the confrontation session, more than that of any others, tend to surprise me. I'll come inside with you. I begin walking up the steps toward the front door. I expect her to protest, but her expression fills with gratitude. She seems so distraught that I have to quash the instinct to offer her my arm to hold on to. Did something happen today? I ask just before we reach the door. My question seems to take her by surprise.
No, not that I know of.
She slides her key into the lock and pushes the heavy wooden door open and rushes inside. I hear a Dave Matthews song playing, and over it, Matthews' loud, animated voice. He seems to be in the middle of telling a story. Are you sure you're okay?
Matthew! Bennett!
Marissa calls sharply, ignoring my question. She doesn't even take off her coat or slide her purse off her shoulder. She hurries down the hallway toward the sound of Matthew's voice. I'm right behind her.
Hey, sweetie.
Matthew comes out of the kitchen holding a glass of red wine. He's in khakis and a black crew-necked sweater, with a fresh-looking small white bandage on his forehead.
Avery, he adds when he spots me a second later. This must be the night for surprise guests.
Like Marissa, he seems startled but not displeased by my unexpected arrival. Matthew walks over to Marissa, who seems frozen in place, and plants a quick kiss on her lips.
Bennett's upstairs playing Minecraft on the Xbox. Come on in, ladies.
Before we can move, however, another man emerges from the kitchen, also holding a glass of wine. Unlike Matthew, he's dressed more casually in faded jeans, a hoodie sweater, and Nike running shoes. I glimpse his face and my stomach plummets. Dizziness engulfs me. The scene unfolding in front of me is surreal. Different parts of my life are colliding and merging like the shards of a kaleidoscope in a way that makes absolutely no sense. The bishop's other guest greets Marissa first, bending down to kiss her cheek, giving me a desperately needed moment to try to collect myself. Then he straightens up and his eyes meet mine. I know those eyes well. I also know the feel of those lips on mine.
Avery, this is one of our closest friends, Matthew says. Meet Skip.
Part 3. Chapter 32. Avery. There's no way Marissa and Matthew just happen to know Skip. His presence can't be a simple coincidence. A bigger, more ominous force has brought us together tonight. I want to freeze this moment and study all the players. I want to pull out my yellow legal pad and scrutinize my notes. I want to take these people aside one by one and interrogate them. But I can't do any of that. I have a hunch it would not be in my best interests. I smile and choose my words carefully. Hi, Skip. As his big hand closes around mine, I notice his fingers feel cold, and before his eyes skitter away from mine, I glimpse concern. Or is he merely wary? My simple, ambiguous greeting has supplied him with a choice. He can pretend it's our first meeting, or he can acknowledge we already know each other. Nice to meet you, Avery. So this is how he wants to play it. A dozen questions erupt in my mind. Before I can decide which one to ask, Marissa heads for the staircase, her coat on and purse still slung over her shoulder.
I'll be right back. I want to check on Bennett.
We all turn to look at her as she practically runs up the steps. There's a moment of silence after her abrupt, awkward departure. Matthew breaks it.
How about a glass of wine, Avery? Come on, we've got a bottle in the kitchen.
One thing I know for sure, Matthew is the only one of us who seems at ease. Matthew didn't explain to Skip how I'm connected to him and Marissa, even though he was forthcoming with the information to Polly. Perhaps Skip already knows that the bishops have hired me. Either of the bishops could have ignored my advice and mentioned it to him. The metropolitan D.C. area can be a small town in some ways, and it isn't inconceivable that I would know someone in the bishop's circle. But if Skip doesn't have something to hide, why would he keep it a secret that we'd been on a few dates? And why does he look so deeply uneasy? Skip stands aside to let me follow Matthew, then falls into step behind me. The hairs on the back of my neck rise. I don't like not being able to see Skip. I am not walking into a trap, I remind myself. I didn't tell anyone I was coming here. I didn't even know it myself until a little while ago, so there's no way Skip could have engineered this meeting. Matthew and Marissa couldn't have either. I exhale and enter the kitchen. It's as gorgeous as I remembered, with its built-in appliances and glass-fronted cabinets. A bowl of mixed nuts is on the island, next to a half-full bottle of Malbec and a red, white, and blue plastic rocket. Matthew pours a generous amount of the ruby-colored wine into a balloon glass and hands it to me.
Had some quality father-son time with Bennett this afternoon, Matthew gestures to the toy. That thing is a lot better than the bottle rockets I had growing up.
Nice. I take a sip of wine, feeling its warmth ease down my throat, then turn to Skip. I decide to take control of the conversation. Do you live in the neighborhood, Skip? I already know he lives in the Palisades. At least, that's what he told me when we met at Matisse. I want to see if that information fits what the bishops know about him.
Not too far away. I've got a place in D.C., Skip replies, avoiding my eyes.
I'm trying to read his energy, but I can't decipher it.
He seemed so straightforward and solid when I first met him. Then, when I caught him coming out of my home office, he seemed a little jittery and off. Now he's acting guarded and cagey. But I detect nothing in his affect that feels threatening.
Skip's house is fantastic, Matthew adds helpfully. He just finished renovating it.
Matthew seems oblivious of the prickly undercurrent linking Skip and me. So far, Skip's biographical data aligns. Yet I feel as if the more time I spend in Skip's presence, the less I know about him. He is the missing link in a chain I never knew existed, an invisible stitch affixing me to the Bishops. I swiftly review the timeline in my mind as Matthew tops off Skip's drink, then his own. I called in my supposedly anonymous tip to the FDA, then I met Skip. Several weeks later, Marissa reached out to me. In between my encounters with Skip and the Bishops, Acelia began unleashing their intimidation tactics. All of these events seemed independent at first. Now I wonder if hidden connections exist, like the sticky threads of a nearly invisible spiderweb.
Do you live nearby?
Skip turns my question around on me. Cleveland Park, I tell him, as if he weren't eating Thai food at my kitchen table just last week. I look back and forth between him and Matthew. So, how do you guys know each other? As Matthew opens his mouth to answer, Marissa enters the room. The smudge of mascara is gone from beneath her eye, and she has smoothed her hair, but one pant leg is still tucked inside her boot, and she looks wrung out, even worse than when she exited her car a few minutes ago.
How was your massage?
Matthew leans over to give her another quick kiss. Amazing. But Marissa doesn't seem like a woman who has just spent a blissful hour getting her body kneaded with lavender oil. A massage? I wonder if this is why I couldn't reach her.
Marissa's been under so much stress lately, I thought she deserved a break.
Matthew lifts up the bottle of wine.
Pour you a glass, babe?
Marissa stares at the bottle for a beat, then shakes her head. I'm going to stick with water and rehydrate.
That makes sense,
Matthew says as Marissa takes a glass out of the cabinet and fills it with water. It's only because I'm watching Skip so intently that I realize he is staring at Marissa with an equal intensity. She tilts back her head, exposing her long, graceful neck as she takes a long sip of water. She must feel Skip's eyes on her because she turns to him. How are the new townhouses coming along? She glances at me. Skip is a real estate developer. I nod, pretending it's new information. This, too, fits with what Skip has told me.
Really well, Skip says. You still thinking about letting Natalie handle some of the sales? Matthew asks.
Natalie again? I think. Skip nods, a little curtly. I can't read Marissa's face because at the mention of Natalie's name, she turns around again and opens the refrigerator door. Then she closes it without removing any items.
Shall we move this party to the living room? Matthew says easily.
Matthew lifts up the wine bottle and his glass in one hand and the bowl of mixed nuts in the other. We all trail Matthew into the room where I held my second session with the Bishops. Something is different about this space. At first, I'm not sure what it is. Then I realize the sectional couch is darker and smaller than the one that used to be here. As before, Matthew claims a chair facing the couch, and since I'm right behind him, I get to pick next. I choose the only other chair in the room, the same place I sat last time. That leaves the gray sectional for Marissa and Skip. They sit a few feet apart, like strangers who enter the same elevator together and immediately put a healthy distance between them. I make sure I'm the first one to speak. I need this question answered. So, you are about to tell me how you guys all know each other.
Marissa and Skip were friends first.
Matthew leans back and perches his right ankle and foot atop his left thigh.
They actually grew up in the same town.
He names an area on the eastern shore. I've heard it's lovely.
I've never been, but Paul had friends who owned a vacation home there and often traveled from D.C. for the weekend.
My parents bought a summer place there when I was 15, Matthew continues. Skip was quite the entrepreneur even then. He had a little fishing boat and ran a charter business. My dad still talks about the snapper he caught with Skip before dawn on Saturday mornings while the rest of us were sleeping.
Hey, some of us had to work during the summers, Skip chimes in. Right, Marissa?
She nods and smiles weakly.
But we all had fun together at night, Matthew says.
That's true. Those beach bonfires. Man, I miss them.
Skip looks only at Marissa when he replies.
It sounds idyllic. I wonder, though, if, like everything else in the bishop's life, the pretty memories are layered over something murky.
Skip's dynamic with Matthew seems to hold hints of one-upmanship. Maybe that began when they were young.
So when did you two become close friends? I ask.
Something passes between Skip and Matthew. Their eyes briefly meet, then flicker apart. Marissa's empty glass of water clinks loudly against the stone coaster as she sets it down.
When I was 16. Skip's much older than me. He was 17.
Matthew winks, apparently ribbing his friend. Then Matthew smiles at his wife.
The same summer I fell in love with Marissa.
Before anyone can reminisce further, Marissa quickly stands up, smoothing the front of her pants.
Would anyone like some water? I'm going to get another glass.
Why don't you fill up the pitcher? Matthew suggests.
She nods and exits the room quickly.
I'll go help.
Skip shoots a look at Matthew as he rises. It almost feels like a rebuke, as if carrying in a pitcher of water and a few glasses is too much for Marissa.
You've kept in touch since you were teenagers?
Now that the shock of seeing Skip has passed, my adrenaline has dipped back down to a normal level. I need to maximize every second I get alone with Matthew by pulling as much information out of him as I can.
Yep.
I glance at the bookshelf to my left, the one that holds the photo of Matthew and Marissa with their wedding party. I have a copy of it on my phone and make a mental note to study it later in case Skip was a groomsman.
What about Skip's wife? I lob. Are you and Marissa close with her too?
Skip isn't married. I guess he hasn't found the perfect woman yet.
Unlike you.
Matthew smiles, a proud, proprietorial smile.
Yeah, unlike me.
He leans forward.
You know, it's a shame he hasn't dated anyone seriously in a while. He's the one I set up with Natalie, but they didn't click. He's a great guy. And I know he really wants kids.
I cast back in my memory for what Marissa had said about the setup. That Natalie wasn't interested in Skip because she wanted Matthew. What a strange gathering that must have been. Marissa returns with a stack of three glasses, followed closely by Skip, who holds a cobalt blue water pitcher. Instead of letting Marissa fill up a glass and give it to her husband, Skip does so. Marissa sits back down, a little farther from Skip than before and closer to me, and crosses her arms around her waist.
Thanks, buddy.
Matthew is still the picture of ease.
How are things going at Coco?
Skip asks, turning toward Marissa.
While she answers, I look at Matthew. If he is at all bothered by the way Skip is attending to his wife, he doesn't show it.
For the next 20 minutes or so, the conversation ranges from the killer arm of the new pitcher of the Nationals baseball team to the weather to the top executive at Howard University who is considering a run for Congress. I join in enough to make it seem as if I were a full participant, nodding at the correct moments and laughing along with everyone else when Matthew cracks a joke about politicians. All the while, I'm cataloging clues being revealed in body language, word choices, and vocal tones. Earlier tonight, all I wanted was to get Marissa alone, but I no longer need the information I came here to retrieve. Marissa's sudden intake of breath causes my head to twist. She's staring at a stack of children's games on the coffee table. They look brand new in their plastic packaging.
Bennett talked me into buying those when we were at Child's Play, Matthew comments. We thought we'd have family game night.
Marissa nods, but the motion seems mechanical. If she was anxious before, now she seems completely spooked. I look at the games. Pictionary, Scattergories, and a kid's version of Truth or Dare cards. What could possibly have triggered that reaction in her? Marissa lifts a shaking hand to her mouth to conceal a yawn. The gesture seems fake. She's clearly trying to end the evening, but is it because of her discomfort with Skip? Or something else? Every single person here is concealing something, I realize. The velvety, expensive wine, attractive decor, and friendly conversation can't mask the truth. Ugly, explosive secrets are swirling around inside this room. Still, I pretend to take the hint. It's time to break up this little party. I want to talk to Skip alone. I'm always wiped out after a massage, too, I tell Marissa. And I must be keeping you all from your dinner. Thanks for the drink. I stand up, assuming Skip will do the same, especially since Matthew indicated earlier that Skip was a surprise guest, too. Skip remains on the couch, sipping his wine, the red wine he'd supposedly developed a recent allergy to. Nice to meet you, Avery. Marissa looks at me, and I can see anguish in her eyes. I need to decide if I'm going to save her from this situation or leave her to flounder. The last thing Marissa wants is to be left alone with her husband and his old friend. The one I'm now certain she betrayed Matthew with.